This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. I'm Carol Crist, and I'm the director for the Center in Studies in Higher Education. And I'm particularly pleased to welcome you to today's talk because of its speaker, Phil Stark. Philip is a professor of statistics and a distinguished and important professor of statistics who's just recently taken on the task of being associate dean of the Division of Physical and Mathematical Sciences, Mathematical and Physical Sciences in the College of Letters and Science. And I'm so pleased that he's chosen to use his statistical knowledge and expertise to look at an extraordinarily important subject, which is teaching evaluations. I want to tell you a little bit about Philip's work in statistics, although I'm going to read this because I couldn't really capture it beyond reading it. His research centers on inference problems, especially confidence procedures tailored for specific goals. And so I think I understand the relationship of that to teaching evaluations. But what I wanted to read to you in particular was the set of applications of his work, because that's really extraordinary. The applications of his work include the Big Bang, causal inference, the U.S. Census, climate modeling, earthquake prediction, election auditing, food web models, the geomagnetic field, geriatric hearing loss, information retrieval, internet content filters, non-parametrics, risk assessment, and the seismic structure of the sun and earth, spectroscopy, spectrum estimation, and uncertainty quantification for computational models of complex systems. And I'm just amazed at that range of things that Philip's work can tell us about. And today, as I said, he's going to bring it to bear on teaching evaluations, which are so important, as I think you all know, in the evaluation of faculty for promotion and advancement, but they're also a critical source for faculty themselves in trying to improve their teaching. So they're a really important tool that is also very little understood. And so Philip is going to help us with that.
Thank you so much, Carol. It's a pleasure to see you. I mean, we've known each other for decades now. And kind of you're explaining my research interest is really basically just outing me for having a very short attention span. So I'm going to talk about two papers, his joint work with Richard Freistadt, who's here at the Center for Teaching and Learning, Anne Boring, who's at Sciences Po in Paris, and Kelly Ottoboni, who's a graduate student here in statistics. The links are here. The slides will be posted if anybody's interested in clicking through anything. So my feeling about this work is really summarized very well by Gloria Steinem. The truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. And as Carol knows, Gloria is a Smithy. Yes? Okay. So student evaluations of teaching. How many of you are faculty? Okay. Administrators, non-faculty administrators, students. All right, so most of us have experienced student evaluations from one side or the other. They're the most common method used to evaluate teaching. They are used by most universities, in the U.S. at least, for hiring, firing, tenure decisions, promotion. They have the benefit of being simple, cheap, and fast to administer, partly because you use parallel processing. You subcontract this to a bunch of students to do it in class. Typical items, two that are required at Berkeley on every evaluation for every department. First is considering the limitations and possibilities of the subject matter in the course. How would you rate the overall effectiveness of this instructor? Second, considering the limitations and possibilities of the subject matter, how effective was the course? So both of these questions are about effectiveness. There are also some ancillary items around presentation, explanations, availability, feedback, time and effort that the students spent working on the class. In a lot of surveys, you find that roughly 40% of students spend at least 20 hours a week on each of their classes, which is an interesting phenomenon. So before talking about gender bias and other biases, which is really the main point of my talk, I want to talk about some of the statistical misuse of teaching evaluation data, where what we do with it is broken, even if the instrument itself weren't fundamentally broken. So one of the things that tends to get ignored is non-response. Not every student submits an evaluation at the end of the semester. At Berkeley, we have a slightly odd way of dealing with this. I think there's something that says that if the response rate is below X percent, I think X might be 60, 70, do anybody remember offhand, then there needs to be an explanation for why it's so low, which is sort of blaming the instructor for the response rate in some level and tacitly assuming that a low response rate indicates something to do with bad teaching in and of itself. So student evaluations are an incomplete census of the students in the class. They're not a random sample of anything. And that's an important thing to remember. So the idea that you've sampled some fraction of the students doesn't mean that you've got a random sample of that fraction. Just to give you an illustration, suppose that you have 70% response rate in the class with an average of 4 on a 7-point scale. Berkeley uses a 7-point scale for most things. I think all departments are on the same scale. So you might think 70% is a high response rate. In fact, I think this is high in many instances compared to what we typically get. But that means the class average could be anywhere between 3.1 and 4.9, right? Because depending on how the rest of those people might have voted, the range of possibilities is enormous. Now, often when you look at assessments for promotions and tenure and whatnot, people are quibbling over 0.1 points, that this 0.1 points changes someone from being below average to above average. Right. So the fact that non-response can flip things by this much is actually really, really important, even on the assumption that SET measured something in the first place. So margins of error are meaningless in this context because these aren't random samples. They're incomplete censuses. And very often when people approach me to talk about this stuff, they want to say, well, can I just say that I had a random sample of size 50 out of a population of blah, 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 and calculated a margin of error, and then I can put a confidence interval on it, or I can test the hypothesis that it's bigger or less than the mean for the department. So it's like, no, you can't. I mean, you can go through the motions, but it doesn't mean anything at the end of the day. So one of the things to think about in looking at response rates is who ends up responding and why. In a lot of contexts in daily life, what motivates people to show up, to respond, to return a survey is dissatisfaction rather than satisfaction. So you might imagine that the lower the response rate, the more biased the responses are against the instructor, the lower the ratings would tend to be. That's not the only reason people do or don't respond. There's a big difference between administering the student evaluations in class versus administering them online. Faculty can engineer the response rate to some extent by doing it at the beginning of a review session for the final versus doing it on a day. So there's a lot of room here for slack, and it matters. So I love XKCD's cartoons. This one, I get in trouble for showing up contented at protests, right? Anyone for Scrabble later? Okay, so with apologies to Garrison Keillor, pretty much everything we're doing with the numbers shouldn't be done. An assumption in averaging these things or trying to compare them is that 3 means the same thing to every student, at least in a given class. This is separate from looking across different courses. And does a 5 in an upper division architecture studio mean the same thing as a 5 in a required freshman econ class with 500 students? And it probably doesn't, right? It describes a very different kind of experience, even if you're talking about the same student. Is the difference between 1 and 2 the same as the difference between 5 and 6? Is this really an interval scale? And no, it isn't. These numbers, the difference between 1 and 2, It's the increment doesn't matter. This is an ordinal scale, that somehow 1 is lower than 2 for a given student is lower than 3, et cetera, but that doesn't mean that the difference between 1 and 2 means the same thing as the difference between 3 and 4, even for the same student. Okay. Most importantly, if we're talking about averages, does a 1 balance a 7 to make 2 4s, right? Does it, is there, okay, so averages throw away crucial information about the variability of scores. So an average of 2 1s and 2 7s is the same as an average of 2 3 4 5 6. 1 and 3 5s are all 4s, right? But this is a student, this is an instructor who somehow polarized student opinion, and this is an instructor who gets very homogeneous ratings. Probably what happened in those classrooms is very different, right? All right, so what does the mean actually mean in this context? And I would say it doesn't mean anything at all. The mean's meaningless here because averages make sense for interval scales, not ordinal scales like student evaluations are measured on. It just doesn't make sense to do it. It doesn't make sense to compare average scores across courses, instructors, levels of classes, types of classes, modes of instructions, disciplines, so forth and so on. But we do it all the time in the academy. We shouldn't be ignoring variability and we shouldn't be ignoring non-response, even if the underlying measurements meant something. But we do. Reporting averages like this is seductive. I call this kind of thing quantification, right? You assign a meaningless number to something, you calculate averages, get 3 significant digits, and look, it's a number. It must mean something, right? Somehow our brains shut down once we start to be presented with numerical evidence, and we stop questioning what the source of the information is, and then we do silly things. All right, so on from sort of the raw processing of the numbers and on to whether we're actually doing some kind of social science here or just scientism. A book that everyone should read, if he or she hasn't already, is How to Lie with Statistics. It's a classic by Daryl Huff. It has very dated language, but one of the things he talks about is called the semi-attached figure. He says, if you can't prove what you want to prove, demonstrate something else and pretend that they're the same thing. In the days that follows the collision of statistics with the human mind, hardly anyone will notice the difference. Okay? This is absolutely true in my experience. It's this notion of quantification. Quantification. Once you have a number, all thought stops. So what is effective teaching? Right? So those two questions that were asked at the beginning are, considering the limitations of the material, so forth and so on, how effective was this instructor? Effectiveness, right? Considering the limitations of blah, 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 how effective was this course? What is effectiveness supposed to be? Well, it ought to have something to do with learning, we would hope, yes? Somehow an effective teacher facilitates learning in some way. How do you measure learning? Well, grades are not a good proxy for learning for a variety of reasons, one of which is that in our institution and most institutions in the U.S., the same instructor who is doing the teaching is the instructor who sets the exams and grades the exams. And they're not typically graded anonymously. There's all kinds of confounding factors that enter, and it's just very, very difficult to know whether someone is giving an easy exam, teaching to the test, you know, something else. So grades by themselves are generally not a good proxy. There are exceptions. There are situations, I mean, many institutions in the UK, the person who sets the exams or the people who set the exams are not the people who teach the class. Things are randomized. They're blind. There are ways that you can turn it into a better proxy for learning, but generally here, they're not. Students are not good judges of how much they learned, right? This applies to, I'm not a good judge of what I learn in a particular context either. Sometimes I later realize that I've learned something. Sometimes I have the illusion that I've learned something and then later discover that I didn't. My experience in math classes as an undergrad was very much, you go through, you watch, it all makes sense, and you go home and try to solve a problem and you're clueless, right? But it felt good in the moment. Okay. There's serious problems with confounding. Does everyone know what the word confounding means? It's a statistical term of art. When one kind of thing shows up as another. So, for instance, if we had... what's a good example of confounding people can relate to? Let's imagine a medication that, or a behavior that people tend to do when they're younger and not when they're older. And you look at how many years of life people have after this behavior, right? If you're younger, you're probably going to have more years of life left, whether you have this behavior or not. Okay, so the tendency to indulge in this behavior, engage in this behavior, will be confounded with the age of the people who are doing it. One effect will show up as another. So here, confounding can enter in a variety of ways. You know, so for imagine that you say, okay, I just thought of the cleverest possible way of measuring whether an instructor is effective. I'm going to look at how that students, that instructor's students do in the next course that that student takes. Okay, and so I look and I find that students who do well in this class taught by this instructor do well in the follow-on class taught by somebody else. Well, what if the reason that the person chose that instructor is because that instructor is known to be an easy grader, and the reason the person chose the follow-on instructor is because that instructor is known to be an easy grader? Right? That would be, you would be confounding teaching effectiveness with strategic selection of instructors. Okay, so you can't just do that. That's not enough. You have confounding. Now, this is an example of avoiding that fallacy, another XKCD cartoon. I used to think correlation implied causation. Then I took a statistics class. Now I don't. Sounds like the class helped. Well, maybe. Yeah. All right. Okay, so that's the issue of correlation versus causation. Right. So before I was complaining about the numbers, but it's not just the numbers that are troubled. Student comments are troubled as well. In an example in the paper with Richard Freistadt, we quote differences in the kinds of prose that students in humanities classes tend to write versus the kinds of prose that students in STEM classes tend to write when they're evaluating instruction. It's enormously different in the sorts of adjectives that appear, so forth and so on. Carol Lauer was a dean at Rollins College in Florida, and before becoming dean, she believed that narrative comments on course evaluation forms were straightforward and useful. And then when she started to read a lot of personnel files coming across her desk, she started to have doubts. So she designed a survey of 185 students and 45 faculty to understand how they use different adjectives relating to teaching. So it turns out that faculty and students use the same words to mean very different things. She looked at words like fair, professional, organized, challenging, and respectful. Okay. What does it mean to say that the instructor wasn't fair? Let's ask an instructor. What does it mean? If some student says he wasn't fair, what do you think? What do you think the student means? Didn't give me a high grade. Wasn't fair. Okay. Well, that's may be true. Someone else is another faculty member. Yeah. Graded people differently. Treated people differently. Graded on non-academic criteria. Played favorites. Something like that. Okay. Students, there are students in the audience. What do you mean when you say wasn't fair? Yeah.
Well, it could mean a lot of the stuff that was said before, but it also could mean like the test was impossibly hard, that no one in the class could have done it, or the instructor didn't adequately prepare students to get the top grade in the class, which is a significant part of what every student's goal is.
Okay, so you were put at an unfair disadvantage, maybe not disadvantaged compared to other students, but that somehow it didn't feel fair, didn't feel right. So here's what she found in her survey. So plays favorites and the grading problematic are kind of what faculty tend to think of, but students, a lot of, wouldn't help me with the homework, and it's too hard, right? Together, those add up to a big chunk of what's going on, right? Wasn't fair. So when we read student comments to try to understand how to use these evaluations for promotion cases, it's important to bear in mind that the words are not necessarily straightforward. Have people seen the Dr. Fox lecture? No? Has anyone seen this? Okay, so I've been given something like an hour and 20 minutes to talk, and I can use that full time in part by showing you some videos that I think are kind of interesting. This one is 5 or 6 minutes long, or I can show you some snippets of it, or we can cut to the chase. I'll just show you some summary stuff and we can go have a drink. I'll play some of this and we'll see where we go from that, because it's worth, here's the Dr. Fox lecture.
For those of you who have subscribed to that magazine, that journal, and he also has, I think, two publications, two books on the topic that he's going to address us with today, and that is Behavioral Games as it Applies to Physician Learning, Dr. Myron Fox.
Thank you. There are several advantages I notice in coming from California. One is that you can wear shorts, whereas the Easterners wear a suit, and that you can wear a mock turtleneck shirt where we wear a tie. I'd like to start today by getting into the applicability of game theory in the field of medicine and in the field of teaching. Now, when von Neumann and Morgenstern started with game theory, it was not long before they realized that game theory was not primarily concerned with disclosing the optimum strategy. What it really is concentrating on is concerned with the logic of conflict, that is, with the theory of strategy. Now, in this way, interestingly enough, being here at the gambling state of Nevada, the question could be asked, does game theory differ from gambler's choice, where there was a conflict of interest between the two parties, out of which one is to emerge victorious and one is to be defeated? It is the application, if you will, of general systems where the entire man, the entire thing is discussed in relation to the ill of that patient, because everything changes. In ping pong, which does not correspond to games of to game theory at all, I have won 3 games, and game theory doesn't help a hell of a lot there. Chess. There have supposedly been a whole variety of differences. Chess does not come under this category because there are a whole series of potential shifts. And Capablanca, having a time in which he couldn't think about this, instead thought for a moment and came back and accepted the challenge of Marshall and outplayed Marshall psychologically as well as outplaying Marshall.
He was worried that he'd be discovered because...
I'm finished.
Many years ago, there was a very great Russian chess player named Bogolyubov back in the days of the Tsar.
There is one small thing, Colonel. Mm-hmm. I have a Luftwaffe code book with me. The top secret, of course. I wonder if you could put it in your safe.
Not a confrontation. It's a games theory. It takes place between Tosca and Scarpia.
Of course. It's a storehouse of priceless art treasures.
Now that has great significance. We say...
Okay, so not only did nobody suspect, but people raved about how wonderful the lecture was. Some of them interviewed afterwards said they had read his work before. the point of this is that it's easy even for professionals to confuse content with presentation. And that if you come across as authoritative, especially if you're male, you can get... people will feel that they've gotten something that perhaps they didn't actually get. What we would like to know is that our measure of that we're measuring something that really does have to do with learning outcomes and with promoting good learning outcomes. So the reliability of a measurement has to do with whether different students would rate the same instructor the same way, or would rate the same instructor the same way at a later period in time. That's not necessarily related to effectiveness. As a thought example, you might get on 100 different scales and they might say that your weight was exactly the same. That certainly doesn't mean that they measured your height accurately, right? And it doesn't even mean that it measured your weight accurately. If you have an instrument that doesn't measure what it's supposed to do, simply relabeling the dial to be teaching effectiveness doesn't mean that it's measuring teaching effectiveness. And I assert that that's basically what we're doing with student evaluations. We're just relabeling the dial. So validity, the validity of SCT would have to do with whether SCT actually do primarily measure teaching effectiveness or something else. There's a lot of evidence that they primarily do measure other things like gender, attractiveness of the instructor, ethnicity of the instructor, the mathematical content of the course, the rigor of the course, time of day, class size, and things like that. They're really quite malleable. So here's another thing I'll inflict on you if you haven't. This is just worth watching because it's just so awesome. Oops, where did it go? I hope that I've queued this up so that you don't have to watch
the ad
anymore.
Tell them like it is, I calls them like I sees them. I will speak to you in plain, simple English. And that brings us to tonight's word. Truthiness. Now, I'm sure some of the word police, the wordinistas over at Webster's, are going to say, hey, that's not a word. Well, anybody who knows me know that I'm no fan of dictionaries or reference books. They're elitist, constantly telling us what is or isn't true or what did or didn't happen. Who's Britannica to tell me the Panama Canal was finished in 1914? If I want to say it happened in 1941, that's my right. I don't trust books. They're all fact, no heart. And that's exactly what's pulling our country apart today. Because face it, folks, we are a divided nation. Not between Democrats and Republicans or conservatives and liberals or tops and bottoms. No. We are divided between those who think with their head and those who know with their heart. Consider Harriet Myers. If you think about Harriet Myers, of course her nomination's absurd. But the president didn't say he thought about his selection. He said this.
I know her heart.
Notice how he said nothing about her brain. He didn't have to. He feels the truth about Harriet Myers. And what about a rock? If you think about it, maybe there are a few missing pieces to the rationale for war. But doesn't taking Saddam out feel like the right thing? Right here? Right here in the gut? Because that's where the truth comes from, ladies and gentlemen. The gut. Do you know you have more nerve endings in your stomach than in your head? Look it up. Now, somebody's gonna say, I did look that up and it's wrong. Well, mister, that's because you looked it up in a book. Next time, try looking it up in your gut. I did. And my gut tells me that's how our nervous system works. Now, I know some of you may not trust your gut yet. But with my head.
Okay, so the question here is, are teaching evaluations truthful or truthy, right? In our gut, we have this feeling that they have something to do with teaching effectiveness. Do they? Can you actually measure something? Is there some way that you can hold this up to a book instead of your gut, as it were? So we already know that there's unconscious biases against women and underrepresented minorities reflected in a variety of things. Grant applications, reviews of grant applications, there are experiments that change the gender of the applicant and see how they're rated. Similarly, letters of recommendation, if you look at the frequency with which different adjectives are used to describe women PhD students versus male PhD students when they're applying for a job, it's a different vocabulary. Job applications, there's evidence that women are discriminated against in that, in STEM fields and elsewhere. Oops, I'm missing a closing parenthesis. Credit for joint work, relatively recent work in economics finds that when a woman co-authors a paper with a man, she's implicitly given less credit for the work than if she co-authors with a woman or a solo author. And so I'm going to claim, and there's a lot of evidence, that this applies to teaching evaluations as well. It shouldn't be a surprise. Okay, so among the things that you will immediately hear if you make an assertion, a radical assertion like teaching evaluations are biased against women are, but I know some women who get great teaching evaluation scores, even when, you know, the Distinguished Teaching Award, something like that, right? So what's wrong with that argument? Why is that not a counter-argument? So one of the fundamental principles in statistics is that if you want to know what the effect of something is, you need to compare it to something else. You need a but-for. You need a control, right? What's the appropriate hypothetical counterfactual world we should be comparing to? It's not this woman versus everybody else on the faculty. It's what would this woman's scores have been but for the fact that she was a woman, right? It's not, the issue isn't do women do as well as men according to this rating. It's are they disadvantaged by virtue of being women in this rating? So there's evidence by my colleague, co-author Ann Boring, that shows that what women need to do to get good teaching evaluations is much more difficult than what men need to do to get good teaching evaluations. It's not that they can't. It's that it's more expensive. It takes more of their time and effort, the kinds of behaviors they have to do, the kinds of preparation, so forth and so on. So it's not that women can't get good teaching evaluations. It's that to do that will probably cost them other things like research time that it wouldn't cost a man who is similarly situated otherwise. Okay. I know student evaluations aren't perfect, but surely they have some connection to effectiveness. Well, maybe. We'll look at that. It turns out that they do, but by and large, it's the opposite that you would expect. That is, instructors who get higher evaluations are generally associated with lower student performance in follow-on courses and other relatively objective measures of learning. I know that my student evaluations are better when I feel the course went better. Faculty feel that? Yeah, I kind of feel that too. But maybe that has nothing to do with effectiveness either. Maybe that just has to do with, is it an enjoyable place to be? Do I feel like students are engaged? Are we all having a good time? Is this interesting? All those things may be connected to effectiveness, right? All other things being equal, the more engaged you are with the material, the more you're likely to learn, but it's not the same thing. Engagement is not learning. It's connected to learning. Shouldn't students have a voice in evaluating teaching? Yes. How? What? For what purpose? Right? They're there in the classroom. They've got the most direct experience of what's going on. But what are they in a good position to judge? Now, if we were a for-profit university that was trying to sell a product and what we cared about primarily was customer satisfaction so we could market our product, we wouldn't need to pretend that we were measuring teaching effectiveness with student evaluations. We could just call it a consumer satisfaction survey and end up hiring all male professors, right? Because they would maximize the satisfaction of the students, apparently, according to what I'm going to talk about. Of course, that would be illegal because that would have disparate impact. You're not allowed to do that, but certainly the pressure would go in that direction. But we're not doing that. That's not what UC Berkeley does, right? We claim to be trying to educate people and further knowledge and discover knowledge and help society. And pretending that what amounts to a consumer satisfaction survey is a measure of teaching effectiveness is, I think, just dishonest. All right. So here's some evidence before we get into the statistics of it. This was a wonderful thing. Just over a year ago, a dean at the Rutgers Camden Law School asked for students to stop commenting on women professors' clothing in their teaching evaluations. Okay. I have to say, personally, I was flattered when I was a much younger assistant professor and in my teaching evaluation, someone told me I looked good in a black turtleneck. But it didn't particularly help me teach better. okay, how much does appearance matter? So let's consider the source. This was a really interesting thing.
To be given a tenure-level faculty position in areas like science, engineering...
Twice as likely?
Twice as likely in the study put out by Cornell, their Institute for Women in Science. So it appears that she's kind of going off of a few experiences she's had and not actually okay. Any facts.
I want to pause this just...
Well, I mean, just as a woman, I mean, if a woman has her hair all messed up or something, this woman doesn't take care of herself. If a man's hair is messed up...
Okay, so we have this talk show of brilliant people evaluating the news... Three guys in suits and ties and a woman in a tight, short, red dress, right? This is already kind of bizarre.
Professor, he's just like a mad scientist, though, so I can sort of see where she's coming from.
He's a mad genius.
Yes, yeah. he's just Albert a genius, Einstein. And that's why he does that.
Well, I can say from personal experience, though, that at Liberty
What's
University...
What's your favorite hairstyle?
I like the mad scientist hair, so hopefully I'm not going with that right now. I'm trying to go with a little clean cut look, but right, at Liberty University, I just graduated...
I just find this horrifying. Okay. All right. Let's go on. Have people seen this website? This is looking at the frequency with which different adjectives are used to describe male versus female faculty on ratemyprofessor.com. Okay, so Rate My Professor is a volunteer thing. People go on there to do... they may be positively motivated, saying this is the most wonderful professor I've ever experienced and I want to tell the world about it, or this is the most horrible experience I've ever had, I want to tell the world about it. But if you think Rate My Professor is about teaching effectiveness, please explain to me why they have chili peppers to rate faculty. Okay, this is like kind of odd. All right, so this is a plot of the relative frequency with which the adjective cold is used to describe female professors versus male professors. If you are female, in every discipline, you are colder. You are cold is used to describe women more often than men. Okay, let's look at the live version of this because this is so much fun. Is this... That's the other one. I can't read without my glasses, but I'm pretending. Okay, so somebody want to... Here's funny. Men are funnier than women. Okay.
Mean.
Sorry?
Mean?
Okay. How about brilliant? You like awesome? Is it
organized?
Men are more awesome. Interesting. Yeah. Helpful. Okay, do you think this is measuring something objective? All right. Many hours of fun to be had with that.
So that is available.
That's online. Yeah, that's Ben Schmidt's website. Yeah. okay, so what do SET actually measure? What do student evaluations measure? So they're highly correlated with students' grade expectations, and I will talk about that in a little while. They're highly correlated with students' subjective rating of enjoyment. One of the things I took advantage of when I was department chair was to add an item to the student evaluation asking students on a scale of 1 to 7 how much they enjoyed the class. And I had that data then to look at correlations with other things. So, instructor, gender, ethnicity, and age matter for student evaluations. I'll talk a little more about that. And it turns out that omnibus questions about the design of the curriculum, the effectiveness of the instructor, and other things seem to be most influenced by factors unrelated to learning. So the more abstract a judgment you ask the student to make, the more that's going to be, the response will be affected by things that don't have anything to do with what's really happening. So this is a priceless study. They ask students to evaluate instructors based on watching a 30-second silent video of the instructor giving a lecture. And based on that 30-second silent video, they can predict very well how that instructor will be rated at the end of the semester. Even reducing it to 6 and 15-second clips didn't destroy this. Okay, so how much information are you getting about somebody's teaching in a 30-second silent video? This is a wonderful study also. What Arbuckle and Williams did was to record a series of lectures in a gender-neutral voice and then have a stick figure animation to go along with this voice as the deliverer of the lecture. Then they told people watching the video that either this was a young man, a young woman, or an old woman, and looked at how they rated the instructor, the lecture, on things like using a meaningful tone of voice, speaking enthusiastically, and so forth. When you are a young man, you are more enthusiastic than when you are a young woman or an old woman or an old man, even if you are the same voice and the same stick figure. Okay? So again, how much credence should we be giving these adjectives in... All right, so what we would really like to see if we're trying to measure whether student evaluations have anything to do with effectiveness is a randomized controlled experiment of a kind that we couldn't do at Berkeley or in most institutions in the United States. But it turns out that you can do it at the Air Force Academy because There, students are randomized into sections of their introductory classes. The exams given across sections of the classes are uniform. Students are then re-randomized into follow-on sections of the classes. Again, the exams are consistent, and you can look at how students do and relate that to the ratings that they gave instructors in previous versions of the class, or in the predecessor of the class, the precursor, the what's the word I'm looking for? Prerequisite. Bocconi University also does something like that. We'll talk about them. One of the sets of data I'm going to talk about in detail is a wonderful experiment done with an online course at North Carolina State. This was reported in 2014, McNell et al., and then data collected by my co-author, colleague, Ann Boring at Sciences Po, where, again, students are sort of, there's a quasi-randomization going on. So we'll talk about this. So here's the Carolyn West. This is from the Air Force Academy. And basically, the one-sentence message is, students appear to reward higher grades in introductory classes but punish professors who increase deep learning. So students who, instructors who give high grades in a class tend to get higher teaching evaluations, but then in the follow-on class, their students tend to do worse. Okay? Here is the Bocconi University study. Again, the one-sentence summary is, teachers who are associated with better subsequent performance receive worse evaluations from their students. On the other hand, teachers who are associated with high grades in their own exams rank higher in the students' evaluations. So, again, grade expectations are something connected to that. So here's the McNell, Driscoll, and Hunt, and I'm going to talk about this in excruciating detail. So Lillian McNell and Adam Driscoll were graduate student instructors at University of North Carolina. They were teaching different sections of an online course where the only interaction with the students was through a discussion board. So the students didn't really know who the instructor was. At some point in the semester, Lillian says to Adam, "Isn't it really irritating, all this email? I don't know how you deal with it. It's so over, blah, blah, blah." And Adam says, "I know what you're talking about." Right? So apparently, the way the students were interacting with them was really quite different, and they hypothesized that this had something to do with their gender and came up with this great experiment where students were randomized into six sections of the class the next time they taught it. Two sections were taught by the instructor of record, two by Adam and two by Lillian. In one of the ones taught by Lillian, she used her name, and in the other, she used Adam's name, and vice versa. Okay? They returned the exams at exactly the same time, so they were equally punctual or, you know, prompt, whatever. They gave exactly the same feedback in all of the sections that they were teaching, so forth and so on. So this is an opportunity to look at how much difference the gender of the name might make. They're both Anglo names. You know, it's not like one is ethnic and the other not. It's sort of, it's fairly neutral, but for gender. If you look at the difference in their ratings when they used a male name versus using a female name, this is the difference in the average scores that they got on a 5-point scale. In every case when they used a male name, they got a higher rating for this than when they used a female name. Now, the column, this is the p-value coming from the work that I did with Kelly Ottoboni and Ann Boring. This is the p-values they reported. Part of my work here is that I didn't like how they did the statistics. I did a nonparametric reanalysis of what they did. So my intellectual contribution is that. I didn't do the experiment. I feel a little bit ashamed reporting on other people's work, but I hope that I've kind of improved the analysis a little bit. So let's look in particular at prompt. So the scale is a scale of 1 to 5. That's a range of 4. 5 minus 1 is 4. 0.8 is 25% of that scale. Get a 25% better rating for promptness when you use a male name than when you use a female name, even though the exams are, the things are being returned at exactly the same time. That's kind of remarkable. This is the column that is ours. This is the column that is theirs. This is the permutation test is ours. So this shows up, this sticks out like a sore thumb in our analysis and not so much in theirs. So there's a lot of tests there. If you're a stat geek, you worry about things like multiplicity. If you test many hypotheses, you have a larger chance of having a false positive result. We worried about that. We did an omnibus test for any difference It turns out that a confidence interval for the p-value obtained by simulation, you know, is between zero and a half, and 5 × 10⁵. Male students and female students, male students rate perceived male and female instructors about the same. And female students rate perceived male instructors higher than they rate perceived female instructors in these data, which is an interesting thing. That in this data set, the female students are biased against the male instructors. So here's looking at that. Oh, first, this is so these are not the same person. Maybe there really is a difference between how people respond to a teaching style of a certain kind. What you know, there might be something going on. What's going on? So let's look at exam performance and instructor gender. So the p-value for the difference based on the perceived instructor gender is about a half, right? This is not at all a surprising difference. It's like a coin toss. The actual instructor gender, Lillian's a much better teacher measured by exam performance. So the female instructor is actually more effective as measured by performance on this anonymously graded exam with a small p-value. Okay, so now on to the work at Sciences Po. Again, not my data, but my analysis, I helped. These are 5 years of data in 6 mandatory introductory classes in different subjects. The student evaluations are mandatory also, so this really is very close to a census, unlike how it turns out in the United States. The final exams are graded anonymously except in political institutions, so we omit that from some of the analyses that involve final exam scores. There are 23,000 student evaluations here of 379 instructors done by 4,400 students in 1,200 sections of the class. And if you stratify by year and course, there's 21 strata in the analysis. And I'll explain, students sign up for triples of courses at a time. And they don't really get to pick the instructor they're taking it from. It's kind of a scheduling issue. And so while there isn't an actual randomization going on and deciding who gets what instructor, it's effectively uncontrollable by the student, and it seems to mix the students pretty well. So in the analysis of this, we pretended that we kept, because there may be cohort effects, students who study together may give similar ratings, so forth and so on, we kept the students together in the analysis and thought about this as if which particular instructor taught a given section was as if assigned at random within a given year. So we're keeping the set of students that they were assigned to the same. We're keeping the exams the same because there's uniform final exams given across every section of the class. all we're doing is imagining that that among the classes, that among the sections that instructor might have taught that year, the instructor was assigned one at random. Okay, and we looked at things like the correlation between student evaluations and the gender of the instructor within each stratum, and then averaged that across strata, and correlation between exam scores and so on. So overall, there is a sort of weakly positive. It's the average correlation coefficient is 0.04, gives a p-value of about 9%. For 23,000 observations, or even for the nine, how many sections did I say there were? 1,194 sections. That's not a terribly compelling result. If you look at the association in many of the subjects, it's negative, meaning that the sections where students gave higher evaluations to the instructor, they did worse on the final. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things about these data is that students get interim grades that include everything up to the final exam. And that gives them some expectation of what their grade is going to be, but the final might end up being a surprise. So we're looking at things like the final exam scores, but we also have a measure of the grade expectations separate from that, the interim scores up to them.
Why is there such a difference, like from this grade, the same between macro and micro? Why on the p-value?
On the p-value or on the association?
Why are they so different?
I mean, these are both kind of in the noise as measured by that. I mean, you're going to get a 20% chance of seeing something that big, 55% because it's negative, and we're doing a one-sided test. So I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. Okay, if you look at the association between the average scores and instructor gender overall, the average correlation is about 0.09, and the p-value of that is essentially zero. It's like highly significant. it's in the individual courses, the significance doesn't stick up so much, but in every instance, it's positive. On average, male instructors are getting higher ratings than female instructors. Okay? I wouldn't make a big deal out of the p-values, but the fact that everything points the same way is interesting. Now, if you look at the association between the student's final exam scores and the instructor gender, it goes the other way. Okay? Again, this is a uniform exam administered across all sections of the class and graded anonymously. Okay? So even though the women are, in some sense, more effective teachers than the men, they're getting lower evaluations on average.
This was the one that only had the one male teacher and the one female teacher?
No. This is the French data with we're onto the French data now. So this is 1,200 sections of classes. 4,400 students, 23,000 courses. Okay. All right, now for these data, looking at the concordance between, we see overall that men are getting rated higher than women. You might ask, well, is that because male students are rating men higher or because female students are rating men higher? And in these data, it seems to be that it's the male students are rating male instructors higher, whereas in the North Carolina State study, it was the female students who were rating the male instructors higher. Immediately, reporters want to make a big deal out of this. Was this a cultural difference between France and the U.S.? Like, I don't know. It's different classes. It's different people. It's different everything. I mean, it's who knows, right? But the point is, big point is, it does vary with all. It varies with geography. It varies with the topic of the class. It varies with the subject matter of the class. It varies with all of these things. The idea that you can simply add X points to women's evaluation scores is silly. It's much more complicated than that. There's no simple adjustment for this, right? There's no way out. is it that male instructors are more effective at teaching male students and or something like that? No, in fact, the male, at least overall and in history, the students and male instructors did worse. Male students and male instructors did worse by a little bit. Interim grades. Guess what? You can predict somebody's student evaluations from the interim grades, which are their grade expectations. All right? So nobody knows quite why this is, but there are a variety of hypotheses. One is, if you make the students feel smart, they'll give you a high rating, right? If you simply make them think they're going to get a good grade, the two things are related. And I've heard that people have successfully engineered their teaching evaluations by making a point of saying, "Now this stuff is really hard, and you're going to be really smart if you can figure this." So that's a way to keep that in your quiver. All right, I'm going to skip this and try to go on. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the statistics. Well, actually, let me just ask, does anybody care about the details of the permutation test that I used, or is this enough? One person? Two people? Three? Four? I'll give you an idea of where it came from. Use this, and I'll just try to explain for the North Carolina State data how this works. So the idea is this: every student is represented by a ticket, and what I've got on here is, say, the score that I would give Adam if he represents as male, and the score that I would give Adam if he represents as female, and the score that I would give Lillian if she represents as female, and the score that I would give Lillian if she represents as male, okay, for the sake of argument. Now, the randomization takes a big group of students and splits them into two groups taught by the instructor, we're going to forget about those, and four groups taught by these GSIs. So here's Adam representing as male. Here's Adam representing as female. Here's Lillian representing as first female, and Lillian representing as male. So the way the randomization was done, if we say, let's hold constant the students who happen to be put into one of these four sections. So every way of allocating those students to those sections was equally likely. Every way that resulted in the number of students in this section being 19, and the number in this being 18, and the number in this being 20, whatever that happened to be, all those are all equally likely. And let's imagine that the gender of the name that the instructor used in teaching didn't matter whatsoever. What would that mean about the numbers on this ticket? Right? If the name that they used didn't matter whatsoever, the score that this person would give Adam when he presented as male would be the same, equal to the score here. And these two scores would be equal. The score that this student would give Lillian would be the same whether Lillian presented as male or female. Okay? So this is what's called the strong null hypothesis, and it's that individual by individual, the name doesn't matter. Now, the instructor might matter. There's no assertion that all four numbers are equal, just that the first two are equal and the second two are equal. Okay? So if I think about, so suppose that a student gets randomized into here, and suppose that this hypothesis is true. Then I know what score that student would have given had that student been randomized here instead, because I know that that number is equal to that number. So if the student had been here, the score would have been the same. Okay, and similarly, if the student had been randomized into here, I would know what the student's response would have been had he or she been randomized into the other group, and vice versa. But if the student was randomized in here, I'd have no idea what the student's score would be here. So because all of the allocations are equally likely, so are all the allocations that keep constant the students assigned to Adam and keep constant the students assigned to Lillian. And that induces a probability distribution on any test statistic I'd like to use, in particular the test statistic that was reported in the McNeil et al. Paper, which was taking the mean of all cases where they identified as female take the mean of all cases where they identified as male, subtract the mean of all cases where they identified as female. So that I get a probability distribution induced on that from the strong null. So that's how the test was done. There's no assumption that anything has a normal distribution. There's no assumption that the student scores are a random sample from some bigger population or anything like that. Condition on the scores, condition on the assignment. We actually condition on the non-response also. There were a few students who didn't turn in teaching evaluations. The assumption was that had that student been assigned to a different section, the student still wouldn't have turned in a teaching evaluation. Okay, that might not be true, right? All of these are assumptions, but really this strong null is what is going on. This includes something that's called the non-interference assumption, which is that the score that I give the instructor depends only on which section I was assigned to. It doesn't depend on which section you were assigned to. So if we study together and we're in the same section versus a different section, that might matter, right? So, but the assumption, the analysis is that it doesn't. So that's where the numbers, the p-values come from in the column. And what we did for the Sciences Po data is similar in concept. Again, a randomization test that doesn't involve any assumptions about sampling from populations or other. Okay, just a quick note on reproducible science. All of the code is published. The data for the McNeil et al. Paper is published. We were not allowed to release the data from the Sciences Po because of French privacy restrictions. We started to build a library for permutation tests in Python. It's installable from PyPy. We're actually planning to build that out. This is partly trying to get Python to be a more viable language for statistics and partly to try to get permutation tests more widely disseminated. I'm going to skip over that. Just briefly, I'll take an opportunity to piss on other people. Who supports student evaluations? Well, the strongest supporters turn out to be people who sell them for a living. This is a wonderful quote from Upton Sinclair, if you haven't seen it. It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. So there's a company called IDEA, that publishes a lot of white papers showing how great student evaluations are. Okay. Another issue on... I basically claim that student evaluations are a lousy way to measure effectiveness, and I actually don't think that there is a viable way to measure teaching effectiveness at Berkeley. I think that rather than trying to measure outputs, we're better off trying to measure inputs. I think that measuring inputs that are associated with good teaching, that show that an instructor is doing, is putting in a reasonable amount of time, trying hard, trying to improve, is a better approach for promotion, tenure cases, so forth and so on. So they're dedicated, available, are they putting in effort, making new materials, revising the syllabi and existing courses, creating new courses, trying to improve, contributing to the teaching mission, supervising students, advising and mentoring, do the students do well? So when I was department chair, I changed the policy in our department so that all faculty were encouraged to prepare a teaching portfolio, including a teaching statement, syllabi, course notes, websites, assignments, exams, but anything that they wanted to put in to have me look at to evaluate their teaching, I was happy to look at. I then, and the department chair now, and the promotion committee would look at the portfolio and try to assess what was going on. We insisted on peer observation before every milestone review. So before mid-career review, promotion to tenure, full professor, step six, at least one person would watch at least one class, right? This is a de minimis requirement, right? This is not enough, right? But it's better than nothing. For the student evaluations, I would report response rates and the distributions, but I would not report averages. The only reason for reporting anything about them is that the budget committee requires it. Right? It's part of the APM currently. Try to summarize the themes of comments. If you see something that exists across multiple classes that the instructor has taught and seems to be echoed a lot, that might be something to pay attention to. All right, how hard or expensive is it? So the classroom observation took the reviewer about 4 hours, including the observation time itself. That included conversations, the opportunity for the candidate to respond. We developed a whole procedure around this so that the faculty could have a no-fault do-over if they felt they'd had a bad day, if they felt that the evaluator was not being fair in some way. Not fair. They could have someone else observe as well, so forth. So if we did this for every milestone review at that minimal level, that would be something like 16 hours over a 40-year career, right? This is not a lot of time and effort to invest in teaching improvement. I would think we could afford to do rather more than that. I'm going to skip over this stuff because it's available elsewhere and leave some time for Q&A. Okay, yeah, I'm shutting up now. Your turn.
Oh, Q&A, great.
Questions, anyone? Does anybody have any questions? I noticed that you, in the previous, it didn't seem like you included the. I'm sorry, I was going to take a second to formulate my question.
Take your time. Take your time. No hurry.
How about, let's see, the correlation between.
Does anybody else have another question?
You can have the mic back anytime.
So this is a practical question from an administrator. I accept the premise, or actually not the premise, I accept what you've been explaining to us here, that this is a crap way to evaluate effectiveness. Does student satisfaction matter at all? And if it does, to what extent? Right at the end, I think you alluded to something about pattern recognition and comments, and that might be something that you would zero in on, and this has been my experience reading tens of thousands of these things over the last 20 plus years. So I'm just interested in unpacking that a little bit. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So I think there's, let me see if I can unpack your question a little bit. Let's start with what sort of objective things students can contribute to the measurement of. The list from the McNell et al. Paper showing that men got higher ratings than women for everything from praise to promptness indicates that that's not a good list. And we know that effectiveness isn't a good thing. I do think that there are direct experiential things that students are uniquely positioned. Now, some of them seem really basic, like, could you hear the instructor's voice from the back of the room? Could you read the instructor's handwriting? Those are incredibly important for teaching effectiveness, and the students are uniquely positioned to tell. I do think the students know whether they enjoyed something or not. There is actually experimental evidence in psychology and economics that suggests that if you ask a student that, the student will remember whether the student enjoyed that lecture and maybe one before, but not necessarily one from 2 weeks ago. So that's already troubled. I do think that we want our students to be happy. We want our faculty to be happy too, and our administrators. I don't really know. I mean, I think that there are outliers in both directions that really stand out. I mean, if you get student comments saying, you know, the instructor showed up for class naked all the time, you might want to pay attention to that. Or the instructor was never at office hours. Although never at office hours sometimes means I went once and office hours had been canceled. It's all kind of difficult. I don't have a good answer to it. I do have the kind of truthiness feeling that, like, it's got to matter. Somehow it has to matter, but exactly how and how do you weigh it? And I don't know. Does anybody have a better, any other faculty? I mean, you've read a zillion cases. But
it's actually very interesting what you suggest. What you did at in statistics is what a very different kind of institution, Smith College, did. That it was every faculty member had to evaluate every candidate for promotion by visiting often more than one class. Mm-hmm. It was enormous emphasis on a teaching portfolio. Mm-hmm. And another thing is students didn't get their grades until they turned in their teaching evaluation. So you got 100% response.
That brings up two things. So first of all, our own campus policy for evaluating teaching for tenure and promotion says don't rely on student evaluations as a measure of effectiveness or organization, right? It's just that the budget committee in practice will work with whatever it's given. So if they're only given that, they'll make the decision based on that. And instead, it would be great if we enforced that and they would kick cases back saying, this is not enough information, we can't tell. We're not rejecting it, we just don't have enough information to make a decision. The other thing is, if we want teaching to improve, we should be paying attention to it, right? So getting people into each other's classrooms, watching each other teach, and starting a conversation around that is a great way to make teaching better, even if you can't quantify how well somebody is doing. One of the most valuable things I've done in my entire life for my teaching was to teach a big ideas class with five other faculty members and co-thinking with them the syllabus, the assignments, watching them lecture, watching how they engage the class. All that was really revelatory for me. It really improved my teaching. At least I think it did. I can't measure that, but but I think it did.
So regarding student enjoyment of the classes, it seems like that would be a potentially important factor when we're talking about the correlation. And obviously, I don't have the data for this, but just making a truthiness assumption that could correlate to student inspiration or student involvement in the subject. Is there any way we can control for that or get to that, the meat of that one?
Yeah, so this is the kind of question that I imagine would get at something like that, right? If this was, you know, an elective, did you plan to take a sequel before? Do you plan now? Did you enjoy the class? Did you find it easy or hard, interesting or boring? I mean, these things that, like, describe the experience. This is, like, important stuff to know. I don't know exactly how you use it, but it seems like it could help rethink the syllabus. It could help rethink the presentation. I mean, all in all, we want to maximize a bunch of things. There's no reason to think they're incompatible. Student happiness, learning, faculty happiness, you know, all of these other things. Engagement. But I don't, you know, there seems to be some tension the way the system works right now. The tension right now seems to be if you need good evaluations to get promoted, the way to get those good evaluations is to teach to the test, give high grades, you know, make the students happy as opposed to help them learn more.
Well, I mean, I guess, is it possible that you could have a situation where helping the students learn more, but in a very uncomfortable way, accomplishes one goal, but sort of risks turning that student off to that subject matter entirely?
Absolutely. Welcome to the math department. Yeah. And the stat department. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. Anytime.
To take a slightly contrarian approach to this, I come from a country where actually in a lot of places the unions don't allow students to evaluate the professors. Mm-hmm. A result of that is a lot of the time, let's remember this, we don't actually get any training to be teachers. We actually don't. So consequently, a lot of the time the professors never learn how to teach. And, you know, so you end up with basically a really chronic waste of taxpayers' money. Mm-hmm. This brings me to the first suggestion, which is I'll put in the form of a question. Wouldn't it really be very useful just to hand the student evaluations back to the professors? Because not go through the head of department.
Yep.
It's basically for their eyes only. And also, this will help because the students will know that they're not being used in any political games within the department. Mm-hmm. I can give you, for example, in one of their recurrent attempts to fire Peter Duisberg here, they've given him courses to teach that he obviously was not really equipped to do. And, you know, so the students actually feel in a very invidious. Secondly, the students are also aware that in the case of a course which may not be taught very well, but which is compulsory, that they can go to Coursera or edX and find a good version of the course there. So instead of bringing this infantile kind of thing, you know, these when we get these kids, they're 18 and they've had 12 years of good education already. Why not actually empower them? Why not give them the chance to actually take this course somewhere else if they're not happy with the professor and get their grade from that? And essentially re-empower them, which I believe is what's going to happen in any case.
Those are very interesting suggestions. So in France, the first suggestion is exactly what happens. It's against the law for the administration to use the teaching evaluations. They're for the eyes of the instructor only, which is an interesting approach. And I think that there can be valuable information there. There can also be... Yeah, I like that, right? The second is interesting because, in part, again, it's an opportunity for confounding. If students are not actually equipped to judge very well whether a class is effective and how much they're learning, unless you're going to have some kind of exams to determine what they've learned, they may end up making the decision of which version of a course to take based on things that don't ultimately serve their academic interests, right? Because it's fun, the instructor's entertaining, it's, you know, whatever. And so being the academic snob that I am, you know, I would think that the typical Berkeley professor is going to do a better job of a particular class than the typical professor from somewhere out there, although I recognize that Coursera and edX and whatever have courses by phenomenal professors from various places. I'm not saying that I am one of those, but I've co-taught an edX class that had record completion rates. Ani Adhikari was the person doing the face-to-face. I mean, sorry, she's great. She won the Distinguished Teaching Award. She's awesome. She's one of those people. All the So I don't know, right? It's almost like, you know, there's test-driven design in software development. And it would almost, you know, be interested if we could somehow do something that would instrument things in a way that you could figure out what really is effective and not. I think that that could conceivably work for some technical subjects. I don't think it's going to work that well for a lot of the humanities.
Just one final comment here. I think anything that removes power from the administration and gives it back to the community of scholars, mm-hmm. which constitute the university, is a good thing. And we're in a position to do that now, I think.
So one of the biggest hurdles to getting rid of evaluations, student evaluations on campus, is going to be the faculty. The reason, there are several reasons for that. One, it's the devil you know. Another is that any solution we come up with is going to require more faculty time than subcontracting the evaluation to students for 10 minutes in a class. And it's the burden will probably be largest on department chairs, and a little less for others. But somebody's going to have to go and watch the classes or do this or that, wade through a teaching portfolio and suss it up somehow. So I don't know. You know, it's going to be work. But if we care about teaching, I mean, we care about teaching. If we don't, we don't.
One last comment. I do, but surely the ultimate comment is the students don't want to do the course anymore. And it is really unfair to students to say that if a professor is sucking up to the students are going to recognize that immediately. Okay.
Sorry. We have time for one more question.
Thanks. That's very interesting. I've loved to read all your articles on this matter.
All two of them, yes.
Is it only all two? Really? It feels like many more. Okay, must have read the same one many times. Behind what you're saying, it seems that the student appears to be a sort of... incapable of understanding good teaching, whereas faculty, in their observations, will be able to. So I'm not convinced that faculty are any better able to actually evaluate what's going on in a classroom than students are. And that's the first point. And the second point, I suppose, is related. Yeah, I'm totally convinced by all the biases. But even when you remove the biases, is there not something still left that one can take seriously on student comments?
So first issue is, are faculty any good at evaluating teaching?
And
better than students? And I don't have any evidence. I mean, we are, as you were pointing out, most of us have no training in teaching and aren't very good at it. But we might be maybe better than students at least in a particular class, looking around at faces and seeing whether the students are following what's going on when somebody else is presenting and looking at a syllabus and saying, this is... You know, this is a problem. Wow, I'm going to use that idea next time I teach. So, there, and certainly we're subject to gender biases in our judgments as well. I mean, that's what some of the other stuff in here documents. So, I don't know that we're better. I do think getting us talking to each other about teaching is a really good thing. Getting us into each other's classrooms, I think, is a really good thing. The weight that those comments should get in assessment versus improvement versus just paying attention, I don't know. I'm sorry, the second thing you said, surely they have something. So that's the truthiness. Like, I want to believe that that's true, but the data seem to show that to the extent that there's a pattern, that there is an association, it actually goes the other way. That higher scores go with less learning. I know there's exceptions. I know there are people who are just brilliant, amazing lecturers who help people really deeply understand. But most points are kind of in the middle of the cloud. They're not at the ends of the cloud. And I just think it doesn't seem, I mean, the data just don't seem to go that way as much as I wish they did.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.